All right. So we left off in the middle of the Last Supper, which they would have thought of as their Passover meal celebration. Mark has the shortest version of the Last Supper, so what he does choose to emphasize is important. First, he emphasizes how Jesus arranged the meal exactly as he wanted. Then, second, he emphasizes how Jesus knew one of the 12, and there's little contextual clues that he knows which one it is, even though he doesn't say, intended to betray him. But that was part of God's plan for the Son of Man. And that's where we left off. So let's pick up with the next thing he emphasizes. Verses 22 through 25. While they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take it, this is my body." Then he took the cup, gave thanks, and offered it to them, and they all drank from it. "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many," he said to them. "I tell you the truth, I will not drink it again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it anew in the kingdom of God." When they'd sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. So some of what they're doing is very consistent with a traditional Passover meal. Some of it's not. So the traditional Passover meal included dialogue, included special food items, and 4 cups of wine, which they probably diluted with water to stretch it so that they'd have enough. And the whole purpose of the meal is to remind them of that great redemptive event in Israel's history when they're in Egypt, and God's angel of death passes over Egypt, and he passes over the houses that have the blood of the Lamb on them, and he passes judgment on the houses that don't. And we hear Jesus is adding new meaning to it, and he's reminding them that it is his body that they are dependent on for covenant relationship with God and for salvation. And so they get a reminder that involves all the senses by telling them, this is what this bread that's part of this meal represents. This is what this cup represents. And I think using one cup and using one loaf that you tear apart emphasizes how every believer, in some sense, is equal in their dependence on Christ. It's that one thing that we all draw our spiritual sustenance from. The Ephree denomination understands this language as a metaphor. So we don't think Jesus is saying that the bread literally became his body. We think it's a metaphor. It's kind of like if I stood up here with a baby picture of myself and said, "This is me," none of you would think I literally became, this became my flesh and blood. You would understand I'm talking about a metaphor. This represents me. There are all sorts of metaphors used involving Jesus throughout the Gospels, so I don't think this is weaseling out to take it that way. When John the Baptist looks at Jesus and says, "There goes the Lamb of God," no one thinks Jesus became mutton. When Jesus says, "I am the vine," no one thinks Jesus literally turned into ivy. So I'm very comfortable saying that this is metaphorical language. That being said, I would reject anyone who says that means communion is just a symbol. I think if you read what Paul and others say about communion, it is a real spiritual event that has a real spiritual consequence on you. And I think the Lord manifests his presence when we celebrate communion in a special way. And there is a real spiritual impact on you from participating in communion. And if you aren't doing that, I think you're missing out on all that the Christian life has to offer. So I would never say it's just a symbol, but I don't think it's necessary to say the bread actually becomes Christ's body in some sense. All right, questions, comments, concerns about that? All right, then let's press on. And the reference to blood of the covenant seems most likely to be a reference back to Mount Sinai when the Abrahamic covenant is confirmed with the people after they've just left Egypt. And there's a portion of the ceremony where Moses literally sprinkles blood on the crowd that symbolizes the covenant relationship with them. And all throughout the Old Testament, there are these reminders that some sort of sacrifice is needed to create a means of relationship with God. And Jesus is here saying, my death is the means of that relationship with you. And last, we get this promise in strong terms that the kingdom of God is coming, that despite what's about to happen over the next 3 days, Jesus and his disciples will be reunited and they will be able to celebrate this meal again someday. Right? And that affirmation is important because of what Jesus says next, which is that the disciples are going to fail. You will all fall away, Jesus told them, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. So that's a quote from Zechariah 13:7. But that's not the end. He says, but after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. So even though Jesus knows that his disciples are going to fail and that not just Judas, but all of them are going to fall away in some extent, he gives them this message that would reaffirm to them after this happens, because they at this point don't really believe that it's going to happen, that they're going to fail to the extent they do, that Jesus still loves them, still regards them as his followers, and he's making a way for them, and they're going to meet again in Galilee. And as we see, every time Jesus talks about his death, the disciples say something that indicates they aren't accepting it yet. And here it's Peter who says, even if all fall away, I will not. So even if these other 11 guys here wimp out, you can count on me, Jesus. I'm the rock, right? And Jesus lets him know, not so. I tell you the truth, Jesus answered. Today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times. And Peter again rejects that, but Peter insisted emphatically, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And all the others said the same. And so it's not just Peter, it's all of them. And we probably would have been saying the same thing if we'd been there. And I think what's really going on here, in sort of a deeper, more abstract level, is there's a sense, I think, in which all of us would like to think we deserve to be saved and we play some role in our salvation. And here, that's kind of what they're saying. No, Jesus, you don't have to do this on your own. We're with you. Even if everyone else is against you, we're going to stand up for you. And Jesus is telling them, no, you got to discard that pride because you're not going to stand with me. You're going to fall away. And one of the things the rest of the stuff we're going to study in the class today shows is that pride being completely taken away from Peter. And I think one of the things we need to take away from this material is we need to let that pride go too and recognize that we really bring nothing to the table. What Jesus said at the Last Supper is really true. We are completely dependent on him. And you need to get to that place. All right, so let's push on to the garden. The way a traditional Passover meal would work it starts after sundown. It's a long meal, but it's supposed to be done for midnight, and it closes with singing of certain psalms. They're like Psalm 115 to 118. So we think that's what the disciples did at the close of it. And then they leave Jerusalem and head out into the Garden of Gethsemane, which is kind of on the lower portion of the Mount of Olives. So they went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him. So he separates out kind of the inner circle from the other disciples, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." So then he even leaves Peter, James, and John and goes a little further off. And the words used here just couldn't be any stronger. Jesus is saying, "I'm so stressed out, I literally feel like I'm on the brink of death." And we'll come back to all the implications of that, but it's very interesting from a theological perspective to think about. So going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." So hour and cup are both references to what he's about to go through in the rest of the gospel. It's the same terminology he used when James and John came and asked him for a special prayer, a special favor. And this is also interesting. It's a great example of how Jesus talked about prayer a couple chapters ago. He makes a big ask for God the Father, which is, you know, if it's possible, I don't want to go through this. And we know from earlier in the gospel, Jesus has repeatedly said, "Hey, it's necessary for me to go through this. This is part of God's salvific plan. It's been predicted in Old Testament scripture." So Jesus knows he has to do this, and yet he prays, "I don't want to do this." And so I think one of the interesting kind of pastoral implications that comes out of this is that we don't have to screen our prayers to only ask for what we know God would want us to ask for. God is not offended if we come to him and we pour out everything on our hearts to him. In fact, I think the Psalms show that is the healthy way to deal with all the angst that you have in your heart rather than dumping it on other people or letting it come out in hostility and stressed out cutting remarks. You're better off taking all that to God. God can handle it. And in fact, it's the process of pouring your heart out to God that allows the Spirit to then work on those feelings and move you to a higher place. We see that over and over in Psalms. And that's what Jesus is doing. But what Jesus does is also, I think, key, which is to acknowledge as you're doing that, that God is up here and we're down here and he knows best, and ultimately we are willing to align our will with his will. And so that's what Jesus does. But it's really kind of fascinating that this shows us the members of the Trinity have independent desires. And so it's possible for Jesus to independently not want something that God the Father has decreed. But we also see that Jesus gets on board with God the Father, so the Trinity, when it's time for action, is always aligned with each other. That's kind of part of the mystery of the Trinity as to how that can work. All right. "Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. Simon," he said to Peter, and I don't think it's a mistake or random that he calls him Simon and not Peter here. Peter's not acting like the rock. "Are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body or the flesh is weak." So this is kind of interesting. Stay alert, keep watch is exactly the command that Jesus gives the church at the end of the Olivet Discourse. And here we see the disciples aren't able to do that even for 1 hour. But we shouldn't look down on them too much. I think, one, it's after midnight. They're probably exhausted. And I think there's also some probably very heavy spiritual warfare going on right now. I think Satan and his allies putting pressure not only on Jesus, but also on the disciples. Once more, he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. So they're obviously humiliated, can't even think of a good excuse at that point. Then we cycle through it again. Returning the third time to them, he said, and the NIV has, "Are you still sleeping and resting enough?" Does anyone have something different there for Jesus' words rather than a question? This is one of those things where the translators really have a struggle to translate what he actually says, because the literal text would read in an imperative tone, "Sleep and rest." And everyone agrees that's not what Jesus means. He's not meaning to tell them, now's the time to sleep and rest. So this is one of those examples when the actual meaning is the opposite of the literal meaning of the words. And the question is whether Jesus is being sarcastic and using sarcasm, or whether he's asking a question. And so the NIV has gone the question route. Are you still sleeping? But other commentators, and I thought they probably were right, suggest it's probably harsher in that. You know, oh, that's great. Go ahead and sleep. Very good. Because he immediately says after that, you need to wake up because the time for action has come. And so that's the word that the NIV translates as enough, or it is enough. Okay? Jesus says, look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. So this fulfills one of the predictions Jesus has made earlier in the gospel, that the Son of Man will ironically be handed over to man. And here he adds the idea, sinful man. So this is kind of the crazy twist of the gospel story, that the Son of Man, the one who has humanity, who has authority over all humanity, first gets placed under the authority of humans. And here he adds, sinful humans, rise, let us go, here comes my betrayer. And at this point, we see the crisis of will that Jesus was having. That battle has been won, and Jesus is now ready for action, and there's not going to be any more wrestling with that. He's ready to go through the trial. He's ready to drink the cup. Okay. Questions about Gethsemane? It's kind of a really interesting little episode. And, you know, if you think about it, I think the stress Jesus is feeling is not just the stress that he's about to go through a painful trial. I think the problem, or part of the stress, is that he could stop that. And so it's one thing to go through something that you know you have no choice but to go through, because you don't have the strength to prevent it or the ability to prevent it. Jesus has the ability to blow all these people away anytime he wants. And so part of the stress is that he has to make himself do this. And that's pretty amazing. I think it highlights, again, how Jesus is more than just a normal person. I don't think any of us would have been able to do it. So the question is, what does the cup represent? I think it's everything. So yes, it's the physical trial. It's the spiritual battle of doing this when no one is appreciating you and supporting you. And I think it's also the implications of what's going to happen to him after he dies, the separation from God the Father, the bearing the wrath of an infinite God. I mean, all of that rolled into one, the physical, the spiritual, the emotional. It's everything. Yep. Yes. Yeah.
But it is a struggle when I come to this part that he's really struggling to save us.
Right. And, you know, so the analogy I would use is, let's suppose your child needed a kidney and you were a match and you're deathly afraid of needles and medical procedures. You would do it, but you would be stressed, right? And so I don't think the stress means Jesus doesn't love us. It's just part of being a fully human being with all the complex emotions we have. And it you know, it's like the guy earlier in the Gospels who says, "Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief." We can have conflicting emotions going on at the same time. And Jesus wouldn't have pushed through that stress if he didn't love us. But yeah, I can see why it's a troubling passage. Anything else? Sure. Isn't there an easier way? Yeah, don't you have a pill for this? Write a prescription. Yeah. No, I'm sure there's that going on too. Yep. Anything else? All right. So, just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared, reminding us that he gets betrayed by one of his companions for the last 3 years of ministry or so. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. So basically, the major groups of religious leaders that make up the Sanhedrin that controls Jewish society and the temple. And we are told by the scholars that during this phase, the temple had kind of a temple guard. So it certainly would have been less well-trained than the Roman garrison. It would have had less powerful weapons. The Romans never would have let them have something of equal strength. But nevertheless, it's armed, and we're told they even use military titles. So we've got an armed force. And here we see something really despicable. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. So the deception goes to the very moment when Jesus gets seized. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. So we see the depth of Judas's betrayal. And then we also see the ineffectiveness of the rest of the disciples. And he said, Mark says, "Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear." We know from other gospels it's Peter, who's probably Mark's source. Here he doesn't refer to himself by name. He doesn't even refer to himself as a disciple. And I think that kind of communicates Peter's disgust with his behavior during this time frame. And, you know, at first glance, we might read this and think, oh, well, you know, this is pretty brave. He actually takes up arms to defend Jesus. But I think what Mark and Peter wants us to see is how ineffective this is. He doesn't attack one of the armed guards. He attacks a servant who's basically there as an observer for the high priest, and it's a pretty pathetic attack. All he gets is the ear. And the other gospels tell us Jesus tells them to stand down at this point, and we're also told Jesus even heals the ear in Luke. Mark ignores that. All Mark wants us to focus on is, you know, the disciples were talking tough a couple of hours earlier, but when push comes to shove, they're totally ineffective at helping Jesus. Jesus says to the guards, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me?" So Jesus' first point he wants to make is, hey, I'm not the one leading a rebellion. Second, every day I was with you teaching in the temple courts and you did not arrest me. The implication of that comment is, if I had done something wrong, worthy of arrest, I was right in your court where you had an opportunity to arrest me in broad daylight and you didn't do it. So the implication is there's no legitimate grounds to arrest me. And that's important to Mark. But the scriptures must be fulfilled. So I'm submitting to this because this is the way that God wants to do it. Okay. Then everyone deserted him and fled. So at this point, the disciples scatter, literally fulfilling what Jesus said in Zechariah. Everyone runs. And we get this other comment that's really interesting. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. So the guards grab whoever they can. They get this young fellow, and rather than stick around to see what happens to people that get seized, he literally rips out of the garment and streaks off, right? And we don't know who it is for sure. A lot of modern commentators think this is Mark, and that Mark has inserted himself into the narrative. And it's a good theory. There's no way to prove it, but there are other places in the gospel where people refer to themselves in episodes without naming themselves. And I think Peter does that throughout here. He's Mark's source. And for example, just before this, I think Mark and Peter know exactly who it was that cut off the ear, but they choose not to say it. Similarly, John, when he talks about on the Last Supper, he'll refer to the disciple whom Jesus loved rather than naming himself. So it's a good theory, but there's no way to know. What it basically shows, what Mark's point is all the dignity of the disciples is stripped away. They are just completely defeated. No dignity, no pride left. And Jesus is by himself. All right, comments? Yes.
Why does Peter even have a sword?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Mark doesn't address it at all, why Peter has a sword. The other gospels have a comment by Jesus during the Last Supper about having weapons, but they also kind of imply Jesus didn't really ever intend for them to defend him. But it wasn't unusual for people to carry weapons in that day and age because you don't have the same kind of police force presence that we have, so there's a lot of vigilantism. Yes. Yeah, so that is a little unusual that Mark doesn't have, or whoever that is, doesn't have on two layers of clothing. So the normal thing would have been to have two layers of clothing on. So I don't know if that means he kind of heard something was going on and hastily left his house to follow and see what was happening. We don't know. It's a good question. So both those things are details that Mark just doesn't fill in for us. Yes? So I didn't catch the reference to 44. Is that what you said? Read the whole verse, because that's different than the NIV. The safely is not in the NIV. I don't know why the King James has that. Does anyone else have a translation that added that word safely back in verse 44. I don't know. That must be something that modern translators have thought the King James Version got wrong, because it doesn't show up. And none of the commentaries I read discuss that issue, so I can't comment on why the King James had that and why modern translations don't. Yes. Yes, I mean, that's what it meant. I understand the King James to be saying that. And, you know, some of the other Gospels talk about how Judas has remorse when he finally sees everything that happens to Jesus. But it's not in what modern translators read as Mark. You'd have to go to other Gospels to find that out, I think. I don't know. I can't remember whether that's coming in Mark 2 or not. I don't think we hear from Judas again in Mark. Yeah, so that's a really good question, is what does Judas think is going to happen to Jesus? The implication you get earlier in Mark is that Judas didn't care, and that he's through with Jesus, and so he's going to take whatever little bit of money he can get and move on, and he doesn't care. The kind of the sense you get from other Gospels is that once he saw what actually happened, he did care, and he felt bad about it, and that's why he commits suicide. But Mark doesn't explore what Judas thought would happen or his reaction afterwards. You have to go to other Gospels to get that. Yes. Yeah, so you could write like essay exams about Judas's spiritual status. The thing that I think is really kind of bad news is the passage in John where Jesus says, I haven't lost any of them except the one that was kind of predestined to be lost. So there's a verse where Jesus sounds like says some pretty negative things about Judas' status. But, you know, we don't need to judge that. That's not our job, to figure out Judas's spiritual status. So, who knows? Yes.
The slave who was here was cut off. I remember when I was a kid seeing pictures of Jesus taking that beard and putting it back on miraculously. Any truth behind that, or was that a legend?
No, that's in Luke. It's in Luke, the Gospel of Luke. It's just one of those details that Mark chose not to communicate to us. So, you know, one of the interesting things about this sequence of events is each Gospel writer picked up on individual details that fit their theme. So, yeah, Mark is the most compact. The other ones generally add stuff that he left out. Anything else? Yes.
Did they not know? Would they not have been able to recognize Jesus? Why did they need a signal?
Yeah, so great question. Why was this signal arranged? And Laura and I were talking about that. I think there's several factors. You know, they wouldn't have had photographs back then. And it's dark. And so and also, you know, logistically, it would have been much easier to arrest one guy than everyone. And I think you would minimize public outrage by arresting only one. So and the people that are being sent may not have had much contact with Jesus. So for all those reasons, I think it was really practically helpful to the guards to have someone identify exactly who Jesus is. So, you know, kind of prevents the I am Spartacus moment, right? If any of you remember that movie where they're trying to find Spartacus and everyone stands up and says, I am Spartacus. And so they don't know which one he is, right? That, as it turns out, they didn't need to worry about that because the disciples all wimp out.
But they wouldn't have known that ahead of time. So it kind of highlights how far Judas's betrayal goes. Sure. Right. No, I think that's a very fair comment, that there's nothing distinctive that we know of about Jesus' appearance. And interestingly, later on in the gospel, someone's going to look at Peter and say, well, you must be from Galilee because of the way you look and act. And so I think to the people from Jerusalem, the people from Galilee are actually a little bit different, and they kind of all look alike to me, you know. So I think they needed Judas's help. Or at least thought they might need it. Anything else? Yep.
I just wonder if there was just a little time passed between the signal and the arrest. So Judas tried to do this all in a way that isn't as obvious that he's a betrayer.
Right. I think the deception is maintained until the very last instant to make sure the guards can get as close as possible to Jesus to arrest him as swiftly and cleanly as possible. And, you know, one of the things that Mark leaves out, that one of the other Gospels tells us, is that when they first show up, Jesus speaks and all the guards collapse. And so Jesus, despite all the precautions they took, didn't have to let them arrest him. But Mark, interestingly, leaves that out. Yep. Yeah, Mark calls it a crowd, too. We have no idea. I mean, we just know multiple people big enough to be use the term crowd. We don't know. Yep. No, I think there is significance to it. Yeah, you remember they were concerned. The reason they originally thought they were going to postpone this was the concern of the crowds, as you mentioned. And so what Judas's assistance helps them do is find a time when there's not going to be a bunch of people around Jesus who are going to freak out seeing him arrested. And so he probably knows that Jesus has this practice of going in and out of Jerusalem and can help them find a time and place where there's not going to be this immediate public outcry when he's arrested. And so I think that the arrest at night is significant, and it's made possible by Judas's help. Yep. Very true. Anything else? So yeah, Judas doesn't come off very well. All right, so next we get this hearing. We're told they took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, elders, and teachers of the law came together. So what we think that means is they took Jesus to the high priest's house. We think the high priest at this time is named Caiaphas. He's named in other gospels. We have extra-biblical records that indicate he's the high priest. Oh, I have it in the notes. From 18 to 36. And if you compare when he was the high priest and when Pilate is the prefect with the Jewish calendar and the days that seem to match, one of the best candidates for the year this is actually happening is AD 33. Okay. So the Sanhedrin is this body of 71 people made up of all the sort of major religious, important Jewish religious groups. And that's what Mark keeps referring to when he says chief priests, scribes, and elders. We don't think necessarily all 71 members would have been there for this meeting, but it's enough of them to be a quorum so that they can make a decision for the Sanhedrin, okay? And they wouldn't have had authority to execute Jesus. They would have needed that from Pilate. So we think this probably isn't a true trial. It's really a hearing where they are going to decide, they're going to commit to this course of action, and they're going to try to come up with the best argument to present to Pilate. Okay? So that's what's going on. We're told Peter followed at a distance, so Peter hasn't yet totally abandoned Jesus, right into the courtyard of the high priest. So pretty brave, but not all that brave, because Peter, we're told, is sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire while Jesus is literally in the hot seat inside getting grilled by the Sanhedrin. So he's like half brave at this point. The chief priests, the whole Sanhedrin, were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, "I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days will build another not made by man." Yet even then, their testimony did not agree. So one of the things the Old Testament tells us is that even a murderer, someone who's on trial for murderer, could only be executed if you had at least 2 eyewitnesses whose testimony agrees, right? So that's what the Sanhedrin's looking for, is to make a record so that we had testimony justifying our decision to hand this guy over to Pilate and ask him to be executed. And they can't get testimony to agree. And there's a little tension between Mark and Matthew at this point. Matthew seems to imply that at one point there's a couple of witnesses who do testify to the same thing Mark reports, which is this comment about destroying the temple. If you read the rest of the Gospels, that's false testimony in the sense we don't have any statement by Jesus where he says, "I will destroy Herod's temple." He never makes that comment. What he does say is that if you destroy my temple, I will rebuild it again in 3 days. But this is part of a theme Mark's going to develop, where the comments by people who don't believe in Jesus throughout this trial are more true than they know and communicate some sort of spiritual truth. And so even people who intend to reject Jesus end up witnessing to who Jesus really is. And Mark thinks that's significant, and so he communicates some of those comments to him. And I think what's going on here that is true is that Jesus builds another temple. And if you read the epistles, that temple is the church. And so if you think of what the physical temple was, it was a place where the Spirit of God manifested its presence in a special way, and people could come to meet God there. And once the Spirit's poured out, like Pastor Dan was talking about this morning, that's what the church becomes, a house for the Spirit where the people of the world can come and meet God in a special way. And so I think Mark is foretelling that development that's coming down the road. All right. Questions, comments, concerns about that? Yeah. So, really good question is it legal to have a trial at night? What we know about that from the scholars comes from this book called the Mishnah, which we date to around 200 AD. So we don't know all the rules the Sanhedrin would have imposed on itself in 33 AD. If those rules were like the rules in 200 AD, this would not have been a legal trial. One reason is the one you mentioned, it's at night. There are other reasons, too, related to being on a festival day. Also, capital trials where someone could be subject to the death penalty were supposed to be spread over 2 days, so you didn't have a rush to judgment. So there are all kinds of reasons this wouldn't have been a legal trial. But they may not have been trying to have a legal trial because they know that ultimately they need Pilate's input too. But for sure, it's not a legal trial. And I think that's one of the things the gospel writers want to communicate, is that despite this, all of this procedure,
Jesus is innocent. So that's why they mention details like none of the witnesses could really agree on what they were accusing him of. Good question. Anything else? Yes. Yeah, so good question is kind of how their procedure works and who speaks for the defense. So one of the other problems with this is that if you read the Mishnah and their rules, they're supposed to start with a presentation of a defense of the person. So they had some sort of rudimentary system like ours where someone has to be an advocate for the defendant. And they were supposed to speak up as to what are the problems in the case against them. And that's not done here. No one speaks for Jesus here. But beyond that, and the requirement that you have to have the at least 2 days before a verdict can be rendered, I don't know of any other procedural protections for the accused. But someone was assigned the task of speaking up for them by 200 AD. Okay? Anything else? All right. Okay. So, then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. So while most of this is going on, Jesus isn't arguing with the people trying to testify against them. And that's a fulfillment of the suffering servant passages, which in a couple places talk about the suffering servant being silent before his accusers. Okay? But finally, they just asked Jesus. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" And that the way he asked that is a common way during this time that Jews would have referred to God. They had such high respect for the name of God, they didn't say things just like "Son of God" out loud. So he means Son of God, but he says Son of Blessed One, so he doesn't have to use the name of God. So he's asking Jesus, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God?" And the reason they want that confession is because they understand that to be a political role, and they think this is a charge they can bring to Pilate and say, "This guy is against the authority of Rome," and get Pilate to condemn Jesus. And now Jesus answers. He answers the direct question. "I am," said Jesus, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." So clear reference to the passage Pastor Dan talked about today in Daniel 7:13. He says, "I am, and someday even people like you will see that I have the authority of heaven behind me." So clear claim to be not only the Messiah, not only to have the messianic title, Son of God, but to be the Son of Man from Daniel. And there's also language in there about sitting at the right hand of God the Father, which is a clear reference to Psalm 110. And so he's saying, "I am the Messiah, and I have spiritual authority in that role that you don't even recognize." Okay? And the high priest reacts like he's been electrocuted. The high priest tore his clothes, which was a symbol back in that day of really extreme emotional distress. "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he asked. "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" So they understood the theological implications of what Jesus is saying, and they regard it as blasphemy. And this is another one of those examples of where they're saying more than they realize. And I think that's why Mark has given it to us, is that who's blaspheming here depends on who's right. So if Jesus is who he says he is, the high priest is the one who's committing blasphemy by saying Jesus isn't any of this and deserves to be condemned to death. If Jesus is wrong, then he's the one committing blasphemy. And Mark's little "what do you think" kind of forces the reader to confront that question. Well, who do I think is right? based on what I've heard in the gospel, which one of these people in this situation is telling the truth? Who's right? And this is a point also where I think we're forced to recognize that Jesus leaves us with only two possibilities. Either he's completely crazy, or he's what he says he is. Because if Jesus isn't the Messiah, the Son of God, this is a great opportunity to say, you know what? We've had a big misunderstanding. I think there's been some miscommunication. I don't know why you think I claim to be the Messiah. I'm just a carpenter from Galilee, so I'm going to walk out of here and go back to Galilee, and you go celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and we'll call it good, right? Jesus knows exactly what's going to happen to him if he says, I am the Messiah. And so the only person who would say that is someone who's either flat-out crazy or someone who knows he's the Messiah and it's God's plan for him to lay down his life, and so he has to go through this. I would suggest if what the Gospels have shown us is true, Jesus is anything but crazy. So if you take the Gospels seriously, I think the evidence pushes you towards the conclusion Jesus is who he says he is. All right. They, however, all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fist, and said, prophesy. And the joke they're making is, tell us which one hit you, right? Show you're a prophet by telling which one of us hit you. The irony is that Jesus has predicted exactly what they're doing. He's already prophesied this will happen to him. He said it when he told the parable of the vineyard and the tenants just a few days earlier. He's told it to his disciples even earlier than that. So once again, the people don't realize how true what they're saying is. Jesus has already shown those of us who believe Mark that he's a prophet and he knows this is going to happen to him. All right. Yes. Yeah, so at this point, we think we're late Friday night, which in Jewish thinking is already Saturday. No, sorry. So the Passover meal's Thursday evening. Then we transition to Friday. The Sabbath doesn't start till sundown on Friday. So that's why there's going to be a rush after the crucifixion to get Jesus buried, because they don't want to be burying him on the Sabbath. Yep, good question. All right. So let's just read through the next episode, because I want you to catch the emotion, because Mark has set the next episode in deliberate contrast to everything Jesus has done. So after seeing Jesus stand up in the face of the Sanhedrin, even though he knows they're going to beat him and take him to Pilate to be condemned, we get this story about Peter. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. So someone with no authority whatsoever. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. You also were with that Nazarene Jesus, she said. But he denied it. I don't know or understand what you're talking about, he said, and went out to the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, this fellow was one of them. Again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near to Peter said to Peter, surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. So they can see he's from Galilee somehow. He began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, I don't know this man you're talking about. Immediately, the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he broke down and wept. And I think Mark has very deliberately put that story in the middle of the story of Jesus standing up to human pressure and identifying himself as who he really is, versus Peter facing a servant girl with no authority and denying his true identity as a follower of Christ because he fears people, to show us the contrast. And it reminds us of how Jesus had to do this by himself, because none of the disciples are willing to stand up with him, even though what they're facing is much less pressure than what Jesus is facing. Yeah. Right, so the question is, what would have happened to Peter if he'd said yes? And of course, we don't know. But I guarantee you that's what it felt like to Peter. But this is sort of, and you know, we should identify with Peter in this story. But I think it's very easy to imagine things are worse than they are a lot of times. And so it's very easy, for example, to imagine if I share the gospel with this person, they're going to think it's ridiculous. But you really don't know until you say it. We don't know why this servant girl is interested in Peter. Maybe she thinks Jesus is a great teacher and wants to know more about him. We'll never know because Peter wasn't willing to share that with him. It's also very possible that, yeah, they would have arrested Peter and killed him. But you don't know until you stand up for Christ and find out. And eventually, Peter gets to the point where he's willing to do that, and it does cost him his life. That's what Jesus calls us to do. But what we see is the disciples were never able to get there until the Spirit's poured out, and they have that strength from the Spirit to be able to do it. So none of us probably would have done any better than Peter. All right. We'll come back and look at a couple more details of that next week, when hopefully we will finish the gospel. All right, awesome. Have a good week.